Look, first of all, it's very great to hear your voice. I don't think we've been actually talking to each other for a long time. But
The last time was in Kyiv in 2015, I believe.
yeah, the time is very not linear for me. So you say like 2015, for me it's either like yesterday or 20 years ago. But yeah, it feels
I
a
lose
while.
track of all time here, so it's like what is time, you know? What is Wednesday?
Absolutely. But look, we have one golden rule for Ukrainian spaces, our featured Ukrainians and Ukrainian allies. And I'm not at this point even sure what category you personally fit. But nevertheless, we have a golden rule that our guests always introduce themselves the way they want and share what they are comfortable would like to share to the world and with the world. So please do, if you can, tell everyone who you are, where you come from, and maybe just a tiny bit how your life has changed in the recent months because of genocide in Ukraine.
Well, to start, it's kind of hard to even figure it out because I've been involved in Ukraine in a long time. I do have some Ukrainian roots, although I'm pretty much like a lot of Americans, I'm a mutt. But I think Eastern Europe and later Ukraine sort of attracted me to it, and I sometimes call myself Ukrainian by choice because I've been coming here off and on since 2007. But it really there was sort of an awakening in me from 2015 when I went back there for the first time since about it was like 2010, and it was like the first time that I could actually converse in Ukrainian with like someone at a restaurant. And this was not my experience in Kyiv previously. And, little by little, I guess you could say I was sort of radicalized. I worked as a journalist at the time, and that is how I first ended up on the front lines in Donbas. First, some places that were a bit further from the front, like Slovyansk and Bakhmut and Konstantinivka. At this time, they were not really frontline cities. Later on, though, that same year, I went back to Avdiivka, which was a very much a frontline city, and it was getting shelled pretty much every night at that time I was there, and that time was no exception. And I just got further radicalized because the big irony is I was living in Russia at the time, and you get inundated with this propaganda and the attitudes and everything, and it just sort of grates on you. And I remember the Ukrainian journalist from Union, Roman Symbolyuk, was talking about how like you try to stay out of politics, you try to be friendly with them, and they just will drive you towards just hatred, really. And so I got so radicalized that in 2016, I decided to try to join the Ukrainian military. I actually attempted to do that in 2017. And unfortunately, I did not get that contract. There was a lot of bureaucracy at the time, and I didn't have a like a long-term visa or residency, so that was an issue. Also, I was running low on funds. So I ended up going back to the US. But I kind of made a decision when I went back to the US, especially when I had my previous job, the job I actually gave up to come here. I decided that I would just sort of prepare myself, both mentally and physically, to come back and work as a like volunteer at the front, in as much as I could. Like I figured at least once a year I could pop on over to Ukraine and do something, because my philosophy is you should do whatever you can with the resources or abilities you have, because the alternative is doing nothing, and that doesn't help anybody. So that was sort of the decision I made, and I was unfortunately, because of COVID, I was only able to really do something like that last November. But then that's when that buildup was spotted, and you know, bigger war was on the horizon. And in February this year, I came mainly to try to help train people. I really didn't think about joining the military again because I had my wife in the States, and I just figured that ship had sailed. But after it actually happened, basically my employer sort of pulled me out just before the invasion. And once the invasion happened, like within the first few weeks, I was just sort of so devastated by it that I started rethinking about, you know, going over and joining again. And long story short, I ended up quitting my job, and here I am. So I arrived in the country this time in April to enlist.
And you're at the moment on the front line. And I mean, look, I know you for a while, and even for me, it was a lot of surprise, because we do have lots of people, foreigners, also Ukrainians living abroad, and there's one thing to be deeply sympathetic with Ukrainians and with their fight to survive and for freedom and help. Even if you are as a journalist, we're all human beings, and we see the suffering, and we want to help in any way possible as human beings, not as journalists. But then there is a big difference between that and actually going on the front line and joining Ukrainians fighting, risking your life on an everyday basis. I probably understand that it might be too big of a question, but what do you usually say to people, like how you ended up on making that life-altering decision, and whether there was even a moment like that when you decide, like, yes, this is the path that I'm taking now. I'm going to risk my life and everything for Ukraine.
Yeah. So first, before I answer that question, it's important to keep in mind that for a lot of people, regardless of their military experience or their physical condition, it may just not be practical for them to do something like this. I didn't think it would be practical for me, but it's the kind of thing where it's like I just couldn't do otherwise. You know, if I was forced to stay home and sit this out, I would never be able to live with myself, like, ever. And so it's, you know, that was a driving factor there. But there's no reason why that should in any way shame people who, you know, are only able to give money, or people who are only able to engage in the very important information warfare out there countering Russian propaganda. So shout out to the fellas of NAFO for that. But also, you got to remember a lot of the non-combatant volunteers here, and there are many, I would say probably more. And, you know, they all risk their lives coming here. When every city, every major city in Ukraine has been hit by missiles or shells, drones, and all cities are experiencing cuts in utilities and things like that. And the volunteers are risking their lives to deal with that. So it's important not to, you know, to lift up the combatant volunteer on a pedestal, especially I'm always uneasy about it, because, you know, as a foreign combatant, I have had journalists just chasing after me since I literally at the border. Okay. Since I got to the border, there was a guy who stopped me asking me, "You're going to fight?" and everything, wanted an interview. And I'm like, what can I tell you? You know, I'm just, I'm just walking here. Right. And, you know, everyone sees, "Oh, foreign fighters. And really, to me, it's a bit insulting to Ukraine, because let's face it, I mean, Ukrainians are doing the vast majority of the fighting and dying. And actually, much of the time I was here before I got to my current outfit, I was serving in a Ukrainian unit. There were only three other foreigners in it along with me. And, you know, this is indeed Ukraine's war, you know, and so I like to try to tell people to keep that in perspective, you know, rather than bask in all this attention as a foreign fighter. And believe me, there's a lot of it.
That's something that Russian propaganda is also chasing after, to paint this as, you know, as a war that being fought by foreigners, and poor Ukrainians are just, you know, sandwiched in this war. And I think that's why there is so much attention sometimes from foreigners to this specific aspect, although, you know, proportionally speaking, we're not talking about a very large number of foreigners fighting actually on the ground, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you look at the numbers that are actually fighting, I think you'd find is quite low. You know, the Ukrainians are bearing the brunt of this war and doing so heroically. And another thing that I would point out is, just for me, I mean, it would be presumptuous of me to just flat out call myself Ukrainian like any other Ukrainian. But I do speak the language to the best of my ability. I have been here, like I said, off and on since 2007. I lived here for half a year in 2017. You know, Kyiv for me is a very familiar city, especially Right Bank. And, you know, I really feel when I'm here, I feel myself at home, so to speak. And that's another reason why I couldn't sit this out when the war happened. When it all broke, I should say the wider war, when it all broke, I was trying to sort of distract myself from the news because I just couldn't watch. And I was getting messages from a very good friend who was basically running from shelter to shelter. And it just felt like the end of the world. It felt like this city that I spent so much time in, and these people who have been my friends for so long, and a lot of my longtime followers on Twitter and whatnot, you know, that this is all going to end, and it's going to be ruined by these brainless thugs, these Nazi thugs invading. And I just, you know, I couldn't sit it out. And so to me, it's very personal. It's not about glory or whatever. You don't see me going around with a GoPro, and I'm not on TikTok. I don't even have a TikTok. You know, I've been pretty subtle about the things I've been involved in here. That's mostly for OPSEC purposes, but it's also just because, you know, it's not about me. I am a part, I'm a small part in a greater machine, you know, for a higher cause, basically.
I admire, and I'm a huge fan of your social media presence, so to say, because it's always been, you know, funny and, you know, and sharp. And I loved how you are always within the context, but at the same time, you can also can easily repackage this into something that is ironic. But, you know, for me, it was also surprising to see that kind of persona and that kind of presence you had before and then when you went to frontline hasn't changed much. So this is a question I wanted to ask you in private. And yeah, I think it's also appropriate now to ask you in the public as well. How do you manage to stay still ironic, upbeat about what is happening, witnessing this horror on the front line, witnessing genocide, and yet still find the strength and the perspective that, well, I would say kind of the right amount of lightness in it, which is, again, very Ukrainian way to look at the very shitty things. But nevertheless, tell me if you feel comfortable sharing it, where do you find this? I wouldn't call it inspiration, but still the source of it.
Well, I would say you know, this is a cultural thing, I think, that is very compatible between just my personality and Ukrainian culture, is having this sort of gallows humor in the absolute worst situations. I was in Kyiv recently. I've experienced these power outages they're having. I've heard the attacks firsthand, and I still see them sharing memes about this very subject. That at the same time they're talking about evacuating the city in case of a total blackout, you got people posting memes just making fun of the whole topic. And it's just an example of that Ukrainian resilience, and it's something that I admire quite a lot. For me, I just think if I couldn't laugh at my situation or at myself sometimes, I don't know how I'd process anything, not just stuff I've seen at the front. I also think it's just kind of a feature of my sort of untreated ADHD personality. I've been shelled, I've been shot at, but like, what can you do? You know, honestly, like most of that stuff, I barely even remember. I think it's just, I'm not saying it's exactly a good thing, because I say, I can't get PTSD because I'm emotionally dead inside. But I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing, but this is exactly kind of, I would say very Ukrainian humor to laugh about, because it's also like, it's also sad in a way.
You know, it's really the only way to get through something like this. You know, I'm reminded of an interesting story on this topic that a good friend of mine who was in the U.S. Army, we served, we were just in training together at the time, but he talked about going to a lecture with a Holocaust survivor who had been in Auschwitz. And the sometimes in parts of his story, the survivor would speak about how they would joke about things and the jokes that the inmates would tell each other. And he just, my friend had one question, like, how could you laugh being in that situation? And then the man just answered, how could we not? It was the one thing they couldn't take from us. And it was like, you know, a form of like personal resistance. And it is what, you know, helped him survive. And so, you know, even in the darkest of situations, if you have that, I think you can get through. Mm-hmm. I mean, that what that guy went through is just, you know, unimaginable, incomprehensible, you know. So, but that's how he did it, you know.
Amen. Yep. That's totally it. But look, this is also kind of operational DNA of NAFO. And I also wanted to chat about this topic with you a bit. So can you tell me a bit what's your relation to NAFO? And maybe I can also recruit your help to tell everyone else if there is a simple explanation to this movement.
Unfortunately, there's definitely not a simple explanation to NAFO. NAFO, as you know, because you've been on Twitter for a long time, Twitter sort of has a culture of its own. And it is very difficult to explain that culture to outsiders. And NAFO is probably one of the biggest, most difficult things to explain to a total outsider. And it's funny because some prominent NAFO members are actually purposely promoting it this way because they want actual government officials and military officers to be forced to explain brain damaged cartoon dogs to their superiors in a PowerPoint presentation or something. But basically, I mean, you would have an easier time explaining Warhammer 40,000 lore than NAFO, but I'll give it a shot. One thing is, I don't know who came up with the original Fella avatar. I know that I had been using it as an avatar on my email for like possibly up to a year before this started. I just found it somewhere. And the thing is, I love Shiba Inus. I'm ridiculously obsessed with the Shiba Inu dog breed. And if I see a funny picture of a Shiba or just a particularly cute picture, I download it. And my computer has tons of Shiba photos on it. And my phone actually has a folder full of sheep photos. It's really a pathology, I think. I really love those dogs. And so I saw this one, I downloaded it and didn't really think much of it. It's just a Shiba Inu in a tracksuit. And then later these started popping up around May. This is when I was assisting and training in my past unit. And I just saw this these avatars going around. People were calling them fellas. And then suddenly this North Atlantic fellow organization, NAFO, just kind of pops up. And I think what differentiated it from other attempts to deal with Russian propaganda, there's really never been an attempt on this scale to try to counter Russian propaganda this thoroughly. And really nothing has been this effective. I mean, you had volunteer efforts in, you know, Ukraine, for example, Stop Fake, or I believe it was Lithuania. And I think all three Baltic states had the so-called Baltic elves who would combat the Russian trolls. But these things were usually either regional or they were, you know, linked to one country, as in the case of like Stop Fake. And it was mostly, it was fact-checking. It was, you know, and the problem with fact-checking is, the truth is fact-checking just doesn't really, it's funny saying this because I've worked in this kind of field before, but the fact is that fact-checking usually does not change minds, because the people, if they're already inclined to believe the Russian propaganda, they will continue to do it. But one thing that does work is mockery, sarcasm, cyberbullying, and in general, just shitposting. And that's the thing about NAPO, is just absurdist shitposting, because you can't really deal with it, you know? And you see how Russia was paralyzed for such a long time. Only like a month ago did they try to get their little they tried to get their little useful idiots to come up with a smear job about NAFO. What they said about me was pretty funny. They said, "I work for Stop Fake." It's like, yeah, I read off a teleprompter and let them reprint my articles. And you know what? Stop Fake is good, actually. Like, I'm not going to say they're perfect. No publication is, but come on, you know. And then their attack on another friend of mine in NAFO was that he was in the Marine Corps. oh, that's awful. You know, so it's just a very concerted attempt by you know, well-known propagandists connected with like Russian state media and whatnot, and it just fell flat.
I agree. I mean, like, as a journalist who's been faced with specifically Russian propaganda for almost a decade now, I totally 100% I believe that, and I saw and actually practiced and experienced that. Just very professional, well-written or made flat fact checks never travel well. And this is not the kind of thing that captures the audience's imagination in general. So when I saw, and I'd like to think of you as a proper, like one of the founding fathers of NAFO, maybe not technically, but still, because what you've been doing before NAFO and what NAFO is doing now is basically the same thing and the same mission and the same attitude. But when it started happening, I was overjoyed to see that, because it was A, actually effective, and B, as a for Ukrainian, it was also therapeutic. I think I said many times before that I don't need therapy, I have NAFO. And this sounds ridiculous, but it's totally true. Yeah, because you see how, you know, this kind of tactic and this kind of community, although, I mean, it's very not vertical. There are different people participating. It's chaotic as, you know, shit. But still, you can see that collectively it has an impact on propaganda that nothing else has before. And it actually works in terms of, you know, people are paralyzed by those people who make propaganda. They are paralyzed by this. So this is remarkable to see.
Yeah, they just don't know how to handle. And that's the thing, is like the issue, what the Russian propaganda, whether it comes from one of their little offshoot blogs or whether it comes from, from the Russian Foreign Ministry itself, it's utter nonsense. I mean, they were trying to say that Ukrainian U.S.-run biolabs were making viruses that target Slavic people. Ukrainians are Slavic people, right? I mean, and they're basically stealing the plot line of No Time to Die or Metal Gear Solid. You take your pick, okay? A targeted virus or targeted nanomachines or whatever. Those are movie plots, right? And they will say this with a straight face. And what do you say to that except you're full of shit? And that is what we need to start doing, I think, to Russia. In fact, you mentioned how I was kind of doing this on my own before NAFO. And one thing I always noticed is that I did not get a lot of, I didn't get attacked by, like Russian troll factory trolls. They usually did not engage with me in the way that they engage with other people who write on the topic. And I believe it's because I just had the way to deal with it. I know exactly what to say to them that they can't answer, and I can dismiss them. I just dismiss them when they're just talking complete bullshit. And that's what you have to do. I think that's what we need to do with Russia in general, is stop pretending that Russia is like a legitimate state that you have to respect. And you have to listen to it or something like that. It's not. It's basically a criminal enterprise or a terrorist group that has a flag, right? I don't really see why they should be treated any different from the Islamic State. they're run by gangsters and complete thugs, and there's just no reason for that state to exist in its current form with its current borders.
Absolutely. And the only peace plan that will eventually work is disarmed and partitioned and decolonized Russia. This is, I think I've been saying it, and I'm saying it every day, just because unfortunately it's still such a radical idea. But everyone who's on the front line, or who's Ukrainian, or who lives next to Russia, they all know that this is not radical by any merits. This is the only way how it will work.
Exactly. And I speak at length about this, and so some of your listeners may have heard me say similar things before. First of all, yes, this idea is considered radical, but I'm happy to see that it's getting a lot more voices now. And some very prominent commentators are starting to talk about it. When you do talk about it, international relations people, think tankers, State Department people will probably go into convulsions and be like, it's regional stability, nuclear weapons. But tell them to shut up. Because first of all, here's the thing. I find it insulting that they say things like, oh, well, Bashkortostan will have nuclear weapons, or Tatarstan will have nuclear weapons. Well, what are you saying? You're saying that Bashkorts or Tatars are like some sort of, religious fanatics who will start a nuclear war? Because we know what Slavic Muscovites do with nuclear weapons. They continually threaten the entire world with them. I mean, it's like not a day goes by that somebody affiliated with the Russian state is making a nuclear threat against, either Ukraine or against the rest of the world. It is a constant mantra of them. We have nukes, we have nukes, we'll nuke you. They've been doing this since before 2014 in some cases.
It's also, I'm sorry interrupting, but it's also, I think people don't realize, especially Westerners and foreigners, how much Orientalism and colonial gaze in it. I know that these are loaded terms, but basically when you automatically assume that once Russia collapses and all colonized nations become free, it's going to be a mess, a disorganized people, like killing each other, all the hell will go loose, because that's actually how they see those people in reality, as less than, Russians, as less quote-unquote civilized. And I think more people should call out those kind of views and call for what they are, very colonial shit.
We have to ask ourselves, how many times are we going to do the same failed thing that just doesn't work? The Russian Empire collapsed in 1917, led to the Soviet Union. Soviet Union just became another bloodthirsty empire, basically. That collapsed, and we had when I say we, I mean in the West, especially the United States, we had the very naive idea that now we can be friends because you're not communist. And in reality, the Russians extremely resented losing what they considered their territory and their status in the world. And then as soon as a man basically came and said, give me your freedoms and I'll give you an empire and greatness, they made that trade. So if we leave that state intact, it doesn't matter. If you could somehow have democratic elections in which some wacky nationalist, you know, doesn't take over, you're still going to, you know, you're still going to have this same problem, right? Because you're still going to have, you're going to have this instability of corrupt people stealing and redividing the wealth of Russia. And then people are going to call out for a leader and they're going to want their empire back. Basically it's like Germany in the interwar years, right? What we need
I think I'm sorry, but I think it's important to add that most importantly, this is not what people colonized by Russia or people who live next to Russia and have experience and are experiencing Russian colonials for centuries. That's not what they want. And I think when it's important to point out, and I'm sorry I interrupted you, but I think it's important to point out when we talk about the future of Russia, what we should or should not do as international community, whether it's, you know, America or general community, this is not what actual decisions will be made. What this little that we expect from international community is to start listening to us. And what you're describing is exactly what colonized people or people who suffered from Russian colonials have been telling the international community for generations. These are the same conversations and these are the same asks that people had in 1918, in 1945, in 1991, just telling the same thing, but the rest of the world, specifically the West, wouldn't just ever listen.
Absolutely. I mean, we have to, you know, we have to understand that, you know, there is such a thing as Western imperialism. And a problem with imperialism is that a lot of it revolves around what the Russians would like to call a multipolar world, right? You have different imperial powers or regional powers sort of, you know, horse trading among each other to try to divide up the world, right? And for a long time, for various reasons, like Western powers, especially after Second World War, the U.S., you know, we had lots of, you know, proxy wars during the Cold War and everything with the Soviet Union. But we always kind of saw the Soviet Union as something that we're just going to have to deal with. And they have to have their sphere of influence and we can't push them too hard. And then there was a similar idea after the collapse of the Soviet Union that it's great if the SSRs, the Soviet Socialist Republics, Union Republics, secede, but the, for example, the territories, the autonomous SSRs, the ASSRs, which were within the what is now the Russian Federation, we didn't want any of that to break up. But of course, Yeltsin initially told these regions to take as much sovereignty as you can swallow. Only two regions really took him up on it. That was Tatarstan, which had an actual honest-to-God referendum with 62% in favor of sovereignty for Tatarstan. And the Russians just canceled that. And so if you look at what happened in Crimea in 2014, and then you look at the Tatarstan referendum on sovereignty in 1992, the lesson there is bring guns. So, you know, that's one thing. But, you know, like it's not a one-to-one comparison because the Tatarstan referendum was actually legitimate. It was observed and it was not carried out under military occupation. And of course, the other region that took Yeltsin up on this offer of sovereignty was Chechnya, and we all saw what happened with that. And on the topic of Chechnya, you know, what you were saying about how people colonized by Russia have been saying this stuff for a long time. There's a speech that is going around from the Chechen assassinated nationalist leader, Dzhokhar Dudayev, and he was basically warning the West that if you don't, you know, if you let them do this, they will just continue what they've always been doing. And the only way they're going to stop is when the prospect of empire just appears to be physically impossible for them. And the way that happens is demilitarization, denuclearization, autonomy, confederacy, you know, whatever it takes to make that impossible. And that is exactly what we did with Japan and Germany at the end of the Second World War. See, the problem is we even today, someone was saying, oh, we got to be careful with what happens to Russia when it collapses. We don't want a Versailles Treaty situation. It's like, look, we already went through this, buddy. You know, ignoring the fact that the whole cruel Versailles Treaty is kind of a myth, you know, Russia went through this period in the you know, in the 90s, and they were able to convince themselves that their problems weren't their own fault. It was just a nefarious West, even though the West was dumping tons of money into Russia and food and aid that was stolen by people like Vladimir Putin himself. You know, they were able to convince themselves that, you know, we can build this empire again. And that's exactly what Putin tried to show them with his, you know, flashy display army. And what we need to do is this next time we got to say no more chances, no more pity, no more sorrow. We're not going to pretend like you're automatically our friends just because you lost. You need to understand that you lost, that it's your fault. You need to understand why it's your fault. And you need to understand that, like, you will have to start acting like a normal society, you know. And I mean, one objection some people have to, you know, break up of Russia has to do with the fact that a lot of places, you know, indigenous people were historically displaced and is displaced, and it is now, you know, a majority Russian ethnicity. But I still think that there are a lot of people in the regions of Russia who, under the right conditions, will see that this is just not working for them. And they should form their own identities in peaceful cooperation with the indigenous people, and push for autonomy. You know, why should people in Siberia or, you know, in the Far East, why should they be ruled from Moscow? There's just no reason for it. There's no reason.
Yeah, just because some big powers decided so. And look,
And the thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, if someone were to say what a tragedy it is that there's no Austro-Hungarian Empire, it was so diverse and, you know, it spanned from, you know, from Czech, you know, the Czechia down to the Balkans and everything like that.
What a tragedy, yeah, it is that there is no, like, French colonial empire or British colonial empire or other similar.
And people will just look at on a map and you see this big-ass country that spans an entire continent and goes actually two continents and goes to the Pacific Ocean. They'll just be like, huh, yeah, I guess that's just how Russia is. Like, it doesn't make any sense, you know. So the thing is, it's not, nobody is putting forth some solution or saying this is easy, but we need to start thinking about it. We need to prepare for it. That's, I believe, what Ben Hodges, the former retired U.S. general, was saying about is we need to prepare for the collapse of Russia. And what I'm saying is, let's not make the same mistake again. Don't build them up.
What is the single most frustrating thing when it comes to misconceptions that foreigners have about what is happening in Ukraine at the moment and probably about the Russia's role? Like, what is one thing you would love to rid or you cannot definitely stand it?
You know, it's funny because, like, I have a whole list and trying to pick one is very hard. Well, I'll pick one I think you'll enjoy the most, which is that there needs to be a lot more listening to Ukrainian voices, and there needs to be, we need to start looking at it a different way. You know, there's this sort of attitude I've seen where Ukrainian sources are always kind of treated as, you know, potentially biased or, you know, too biased or, you know, automatically unreliable and can be dismissed off the bat. Now, I don't want to say nobody's, you know, right or factually correct simply by virtue that they're Ukrainian. I'm sure there's plenty of people in this country with some pretty ridiculous ideas, but it's an issue where Ukrainian voices haven't really been heard. We haven't really, especially on an international scale, we have not heard enough from Ukrainians. So, and I often just see this sort of blanket dismissal of Ukrainians, and I see a sort of there is a tendency to look at very innocuous expressions of Ukrainian identity or just concern for certain issues like the language. There's a tendency to call that a sort of like pathological nationalism or imply that this is nationalist or something like that. Whereas what you're doing when you do that, you're basically assuming by default that the prominence of the Russian language, for example, is just the natural state of affairs. And there is definitely a bias, I would say, where a Russian source speaking on something, particularly if they're seen as opposition or something or critical of Putin, they will just kind of be, their words will be taken at face value. And the question of could this person still be biased against Ukraine or for Russia is just kind of not asked. Whereas with Ukraine, you know, there's kind of this, like, I want to say like an asterisk, like, you know, oh, this source might be, you know, might be biased because it's Ukrainian. Well, you know, why is the, why do we not do that for a lot of Russian sources, especially if they, you know, like I said, we tend to be, the media tends to be far too, I want to say, credulous when it comes to any Russian labeled a Putin critic. I'm not going to start naming names now, but, you know, we both could probably have a long list of names.
No shade. Yeah.
Yeah. So the issue is we need to get more Ukrainian voices out there. And yeah, some of them may be wrong or may have, you know, may put out information that's not factually correct, but that's going to happen in any country. And when you give enough voices, when you talk to enough people, you will, the good will basically rise to the top, I think. And the important thing is that now you actually are getting all the perspectives. And that's the thing, mm-hmm. it's funny because a lot of times your major media sources will sort of go out of their way to be unbiased towards Russia, but they don't exercise the same concern when it comes to, when it comes to Ukraine.
Absolutely. And sometimes, I mean, I have my own kind of answer to that, why is probably from so many years working actually for Western media. And it's actually very simple in my head, at least, that by default, they don't treat Ukrainians as civilized enough to have the depth to form an opinion that is not emotional or balanced or factual. This is, in my opinion, in my experience, this is as simple as that, where in fact, by default, a Russian person can automatically do that because, oh, they're civilized enough. They're like, as you know, almost as equal as we are in the eyes of many Westerners. But anyhow, look, we'll have to wrap up. But before we go, I wanted to ask you our favorite question, which is, I think in your case, it's safe for us not to alter it and adopt, because we usually ask Ukrainians in the last, it's already 9 months, is in any way your relation or you or your own identity, and in your case, also your Ukrainian identity has changed due to genocide in Ukraine?
I think this has steeled my resolve to, for the cause. I think it is basically convinced me that, you know, there's no going back to normal after this. Russia will have to face a horrible punishment, a retribution not seen since 1945 for its crimes. And as far as identity, one thing I noticed is that since I came back here, I tend to speak Ukrainian first, even though I technically know Russian better. But I'm happy to see, even within a few months, I'm like forgetting Russian. And even when I try to start the conversation in Russian in order to, you know, better facilitate something, I just default back to Ukrainian. So it's really grown on me. And because honestly, like for me, I have no reason to use Russian unless it's for communication. So for me to, you know, speak only Ukrainian here is perfect. But yeah, that's pretty much it. It's just basically convinced me that this is the right thing to do. Because, you know, the question is, like I said, how long are we going to keep doing this? How many genocides are we going to have? How many refugee crises are we going to have? And to me, it's, you know, like I said, it's a very personal thing. There are times when, I get these intrusive thoughts about things going on, and I get pretty pissed. I sometimes grip my teeth a bit when I think about this stuff, and just think the audacity of Russia to do what they do to steal children, to tell people they are torturing them for their own good, to tell them that they're just pawns of the West, and the audacity of them to just say, we're claiming this land, and to turn millions of Ukrainians into refugees where they face exploitation and harassment. The idea of these guys getting away with it and sending their kids to elite schools in the West and having vacations in Europe, if they think they're going to get away with that, they got another thing coming. And I believe anybody who supports this cause, definitely, like I said, retribution by any means necessary. And I certainly hope there are people who outrank me in the hierarchy here in Ukraine who are considering, doing what may need to be done.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your time, especially it's so valuable on the front line. But this is a bit sad, but also the most beautiful thing that I always remind myself when we talk, when I talk to friends on the front lines, and the things we discuss, and they are always so deep because there's so much at stake that a lot of things in your own perspective get clearer. But also you realize that you basically have our best people on the front line. There are people who are journalists and, former directors and artists and whoever, but they're all like brilliant young people with a lot to share with the rest of the world, with a lot to say to the rest of the world, but they're forced to fight this evil on the front line with an actual gun in their hands. And I just really hope you come back safe and healthy, and we can have the same discussions and we can continue in normal circumstances. And come back so we can continue. And we're really waiting for you home as well. So thank you so much for spending this time.
You're welcome. And I wish for the same. And as always, Slava Ukraini.
Yeah, I'm Slava.